Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
The Mormon Tabernacle Choir is what most people know about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They also think of polygamy, an early practice of the Mormons. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. On this week's Spirit of Things, I'm in Salt Lake City, the engine room of this remarkably prosperous religious community. You're with Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. Founded by Joseph Smith in the 1830s and continued by Brigham Young, the Mormon Church is an American religion that started in New York State and moved westward, finally settling in Utah, where they established Salt Lake City and turned the arid valley of the Wasatch Mountains into rich farmland. They were on the run from prosecution for their practice of polygamy, which they officially relinquished in 1896. The Mormons challenged Christian beliefs in other ways with their additional scriptures, the Book of Mormon, and their belief that Jesus Christ will return to America, the Promised Land. They also believe in man's ability to achieve immortality and reunion with deceased family members in the afterlife, hence the Mormon interest in genealogy. We'll hear about their remarkable library of family history later in the program. Practically, Mormon theology has vital consequences. Grace is balanced by a consistent belief that the performance of duty and Christian acts of service are also necessary for salvation. To be a Mormon is to be a lifelong volunteer, like elders Mr. and Mrs. Thompson, who I met at the church's Humanitarian Center in Salt Lake City.
Well, it's part of our church welfare program, and as such, we want to follow Jesus Christ's example in the way he served others and helped others. Anyone who is in need, who needs a step up, a hand up, we would like to assist in that work. And as volunteers, we have a great many in our church. People love to help other people, and because they are a covenant people, they have made actual covenants to follow Jesus Christ and in following him become more like him. And that is, in essence, to serve others.
How is the work of the Humanitarian Center funded?
Basically, it's all pretty well donations. Donations of time, of talent, of money. And the things that we actually buy comes with donated money. There's no church tithing money involved in here. It's all money that's donated particularly just to this cause.
And let's talk about the volume of things. I mean, I've just gone through the center and seen large bales of clothing. How much clothing goes through here?
We receive from our Desert Industries thrift stores about 400,000 pound bales a week of used clothing. And that, in turn, is used to send to other people. We send it out in 100-pound bales. And each of the individuals that assist us with that, our associates, try to do about 4 of those 1,000-pound bales a day. So that means, say we have 110 people here, that's a lot of clothing to put through.
And some of those associates that I saw were obviously from other countries. Can you tell me about who does the work here?
Well, of course, we have a small paid staff that are employees of the church, and we have church service missionaries that are here by assignment. But the bulk of the work is done by what we refer to as our associates. These are individuals that are having trouble finding meaningful employment. Immigrants, those that don't have the education or the experience to qualify for a meaningful job. And they are the ones that basically will do the work. We'll train them on how to do the work, but we train them in other things that they need to know to find employment. And we're not here to be an employer for them. We're here to train them and place them in meaningful employment. So they're going to learn about the importance of attendance, the importance of following rules, the importance of the quality of work they do. And once they've learned that, and once we've helped them with their English, then we'll assist them in finding permanent employment.
And how successful has that been?
In many years, they've had many employment opportunities for these people. This past year in 2007, they were able to place 110 individuals into meaningful employment, which gives them a step up. It gives them self-reliance. They can now help take care of their families and puts them on the road to recovery.
Where do they come from? How do you find them?
These are people that are in the local community that are referred to us by a local bishop, or they're referred by other agencies through our welfare services program.
So are they necessarily members of the LDS Church?
No, in fact, the majority are not members of the church. We don't put any qualifications on that. We want to help anyone who needs that assistance.
Well, we walked through a couple of floors of this building, and there were several kits displayed there. Can you tell me about the kind of aid that you distribute?
Well, first of all, we want to respond and be the first on response in case of a disaster. People that are routed out of their homes because of floods or earthquake or hurricanes don't have the hygiene things that they need. So the number one thing we do here is a hygiene kit, which will give a family of four the toothbrush, the soap, the towels, and the things they need for about a week. In addition to that, we have cleaning kits. So when they go back to their homes, they have the materials they need, the bleaches, the scrubbing brushes, and all of that they can to put their home back in a cleanly fashion. Kits to help with the newborns, where they're got youngsters and they give them the towels and the diapers and the things that they need to assist. Just something to maintain them for a short while till they can get back on their own.
Well, this is certainly hurricane country, isn't it? Especially recently.
Yes.
How have the LDS Church members been involved?
In the past, we usually have in our bishop's storehouse a group of items to send out. And we will have an abundance of that so that we will be able to step right in and send them. With the hurricanes coming one right upon another, we were running out of these supplies. So our manager emailed our welfare representative in this area, and he in turn emailed Stake Presidents, which is another smaller division of people. And then the next down is a ward, and they were notified and given an assignment to please come and volunteer if they could to help us put these things together, which we did hygiene kits, we did book kits, and we did cleaning kits. We had, over a period of 5 weeks, we had over 5,000 people come into the center on a daily basis, 5 days a week, from 8 until 12, and then again from 12:30 until 4, to put these kits together. We were able to send those out quickly to the other two hurricane victims that were affected by that, and then were able to fill our warehouse as well.
And what about there on site? I mean, these people here who you're describing are volunteers, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
So they've been sacrificing a lot of their time.
That's right.
What about on site? Do young people go down and help with the cleanup?
Yes, in that area, oftentimes the church as a whole will come in that particular area where the hurricane or the disaster is. They will get together as ward groups, which is the smallest division, and they will assist in helping with the cleanup when the materials get there.
Elder Thompson, what about the relationship to other churches? I mean, churches, most of them have some kind of aid programs. Is the LDS way out in front? I mean, they must be pretty envious.
In many cases, I think we are, mainly because of the speed with which we can respond. We've got the supplies now. We can put them on a truck and have them on their way very quickly. That kind of puts us in the forefront. But we partner with anyone, particularly outside of the United States. We'll partner with the Red Cross, the Red Crescent, or other organizations, depending on the location. So we work closely with others. We're not trying there to do it all ourselves.
What about local churches here, the Roman Catholic Church, for example?
I think we have a good relation established with them. They participate with us with them, and We have mutual meetings to work on situations such as this.
It sounds like all of this humanitarian work has done a lot to perhaps break down some of the prejudices around the Mormon Church.
We would certainly hope so. We try really hard to, like my husband mentioned, to work with these other individuals and other churches so that we can assist one another in accomplishing different tasks.
Do you often get people saying, oh, you're doing this in order to gain converts?
We've been accused of that, particularly when we'll go into an area with all of our helpers wearing their brightly colored shirts. But it's not a PR effort. It's an effort to designate who we are and what we're there. And once we've been in and proven what we can do, then we're welcome back in the hills with our brightly colored shirts or waved right in where others are scrutinized more closely. So we've proven ourselves, but no, it's not a PR effort. We do very little publicizing of what we do.
Is the distribution of the Book of Mormon ever part of your kits?
No, it is not. We don't proselyte from this. And even though we have missionaries that come out and take tours, we do not proselyte in the humanitarian effort.
And in terms of the work here in the humanitarian centers, such as what you're doing now, taking tours, are the people who work here volunteering their time, or are they on their two-year missionary sort of stint? Or
There are some employed people who are employed by the church who work here as a full-time position, but the majority are volunteers. Even the service missionaries themselves, most of them have asked to go on a mission and have asked to serve here. In our case, we were called to do it. We had not asked, but were called as a full-time missionary couple. The service missionaries, often they may know a neighbor that works here or have been interested in doing humanitarian, and they will request it through their local bishop.
And in the past, have you been involved in this kind of work overseas?
Not overseas. Most of our efforts have been here within the United States.
So you've been acting as a missionary couple here for some years in this field?
Not actually in humanitarian. We went on a full-time mission to Boston, Massachusetts, and worked in the mission office there as a missionary couple. And then we've served many local missions here as service missionaries.
So how much longer here at the Humanitarian Center for the two of you?
We've just begun. We've been here 2 months, and we have an 18-month call. So we're just getting involved.
When does an LDS couple ever stop being called to service?
I guess when they decide to say no, but most of us don't because we enjoy it so much.
Yes, I noticed that some of the people contributing to this work are in their 90s.
Mm-hmm. This is true, and it's just a way of life, the way we've been raised, and we enjoy doing it. I think the rewards are as great to us, if not more so, than the people we serve.
Well, I think you're both probably right. Thanks so much for speaking to me.
You're welcome.
You bet, sir.
Elders Mr. and Mrs. Thompson at the Mormon Humanitarian Center in Salt Lake City. I'm Rachel Kahn. You're with the Spirit of Things on Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. It was the first snowfall of the winter, and my next stop was Welfare Square in Salt Lake City, whose landmark is a grain elevator constructed in 1940 to store wheat for the last days. Today it holds 16 million pounds of it. Welfare Square is a 10-acre lot housing several manufacturing facilities and the Bishop's Storehouse, where the Mormon ethic of service is put into practice. Elder Jim Goodrich is the manager of Welfare Square.
Right now we're operating 139 Bishop Storehouses. About 30 of those are in international locations. The rest are in United States and Canada.
And the people here, such as the babies crying around here with their mothers, these are the people who are in need.
They are. Let me explain to you how this happens. When an individual comes to the store, they come with a request that's already been completed by their bishop or church leader. He sits down, usually with the help of a woman in the ward, and tries to decide what a family's needs would be for a period of about 2 weeks. They come to with their order completed.
Let me just say something about this order. It's a page, and it has categories like canned meats, canned soups, canned fruits, fresh fruits, sugar and flour, jams and condiments, baby products, household products, and even personal products. So these things are checked off.
And then we assign a volunteer to walk the person through the storehouse and complete the order that the bishop has requested. When they've completed it, they simply sign having received it, and they're on their way.
Walking away a bit from the noise. Very unhappy baby there.
Deseret is a term that kind of implies, has reference to the honeybee. The icon of the beehive is sort of a symbol of working together to make good things happen.
Well, it certainly is a very good symbol for the Mormons, isn't it?
It is. You'll notice on the product that there's no prices on the cans. There's no cashier in the store. Some people say this is kind of the best food that money can't buy. And that's how it is obtained, by individuals who are in need. We'll also explain to you how people often just walk in off the street, and we'll explain that at another site.
Yes, I mean, I imagine it's well known that you can get good food here and you don't have to pay for it. So, you know, how do you keep them from the door?
Now, there is one factor, as we talked about the origin of this system. It's then the bishop's responsibility, once the person receives the food, to find some way that they can contribute in return, to work for what they receive. A recipient might cook meals for a widow. They might tend the children of a single mother while she goes to a doctor's appointment. They may help clean the buildings where we worship. There's just a variety of many things that the bishop then asks them to do to give something in return, so that it's not a dull system. That's the difficult part of the system. And it's a challenge for a bishop to come up with assignments and to follow through and to help them. But it really is one of the secrets of the system as well.
Can you explain why the Mormons are very shy of the dole, don't want their members to be dependent on government assistance?
I think that, again, goes way back to the origin of the church and the Savior's teachings, that we ought to be self-reliant and care for ourselves. Those on a dole, it develops an attitude of dependence and also then entitlement.
Well, how do Mormons feel about income tax then? Do they not like paying it?
We honor all of those government requirements to the government. Certainly believe in supporting and sustaining our governmental leaders. You'll see the meat press section over here. We do have our own cattle and a place where we process the meat products. You'll see at the end of the tour where these dairy products are processed.
Don't the Mormons have one of the largest cattle industries and very large agricultural business?
In addition to the farms that produce a product for our welfare system, the church also manages a number of for-profit farms where we pay taxes on just as any other business would. We do have one of the largest cattle raising projects. That's a for-profit business venture. The farms that produce the products that we use in our system here are tax exempt because of the nature of how they're being used. Just notice this sign, Rachel, as we walk back through. And it's the transient service office. I would prefer to talk about that as we get away from the people that we're talking about.
So here we are in a big warehouse, and I can smell bread being baked.
You'll see that in just a moment. The office we just walked past is what we call a transient services office. In this particular facility, we see almost 100 people every day who just walk off the street, homeless or otherwise in need. We have some individuals here that they can meet with and try to assess what their needs are. And if they're willing to work, we typically will provide them some food at the end of the day. We may buy a bus ticket to get them to a family member's home, or otherwise try to assist. We have on staff a full-time employment specialist that, if those folks want to, we'll have him meet with them, and we put about 60 of those homeless folks into full-time employment every month.
That must compete with the government social welfare services.
It's certainly not our desire to compete. There's enough need that we can all do our job and have plenty left over to do still.
Especially now in these economic downturn times.
Absolutely. We also have two missionaries on staff here that if individuals are desirous, we can try to help them find a place to live. They're very knowledgeable about the resources in the community and apartments, complexes, and etc. And we put probably 15 to 20 of those into housing as well. And so if we can get them off the street and get them a job, maybe they can start to get their lives back together and be self-reliant, which is one of the primary goals of our system, is to try to help people become self-reliant. This display here is a representation of another one of the humanitarian projects that the church gets involved with. In the event of a disaster or an emergency, getting food to people is a priority. With a group of volunteers like this, we can package about 1,000 of those food boxes in an hour. This particular configuration is the food box that was sent to victims of the Texas hurricanes just recently. Believe it or not, all of that food will fit in that box.
And it consists of fruit drink mix and macaroni and cheese, some oil, carnation milk, peanut butter, rice, quite a lot of things there.
A variety of products. It's designed to feed a family of four for about a week. Depending on the emergency, we may alter what's in the box. For victims of Katrina a couple of years ago, we sent nothing but the canned goods because you can open this and eat it cold right out of the can. And these folks didn't have the ability to heat food or a place to do so. So it didn't make much sense to send them beans and rice.
Right. And there's also a cleaning kit here.
This was originated with Katrina as well, that following the emergency, people needed a way to get back in and start the cleanup process. We put together a very simple cleaning kit. It's just a bucket with some bleach and scrubbing brushes, some soap, some gloves, some masks, that they could get back into those homes that were now quite mold-infested, many of them, and start the cleanup process. That's become one of the more popular items in our relief effort. The interesting thing, the thing that's been most appreciated, is the bucket. So it can be universally used for a variety of things.
And it says very clearly, a gift from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
That is true. We've got a 10-acre lot to walk and a lot
to see.
Okay,
all right.
I really would like to share just a personal story about this. I serve in one of those lay ministry roles as well. I had an opportunity to bring my congregation down here to package food when it was going to Honduras. I think you saw a film out at the Humanitarian Center of that Hurricane Mitch. My state came down. In fact, I'm even in the picture there.
Ah, you are indeed.
The one with all the hair. We were able to package the food and had it ready to go, but we didn't have a way to get it there. A woman happened to go into our church headquarters and just asked the question, she says, I feel like there's something I ought to be doing. What can I do to help? The gentleman said, there really isn't anything, ma'am. We've got everything ready. What we need is an airplane. And they parted ways. Within the hour, she called back and said, Brother Openshaw, I've got your airplane. Her husband was a colonel at Hill Air Force Base that's about 35 miles north of here. She went home and got on the phone and just, you know, dear. Within a couple of hours, he was able to negotiate and get clearance from the Air National Guard to dispatch a plane. It was loaded that night at Hill Air Force Base. It flew all night long. Then you saw a picture of it landing in Honduras, where it was met by 400 members of the church, and within a couple of hours, it was unloaded and out into the hands of the people who need it. And I think you saw a picture of a lady molding bread in her hands. To me, that's just a witness that a father in heaven cares about his children and finds a way. I don't think it was just by chance that woman walked in and said, isn't there something I can do? I think the Lord was able to use her to make something good happen.
It also helps that the Mormons are so well organized.
Well, thank you. We try.
And we're just going into a bakery lots and lots of loaves of bread.
Here we bake about 3,000 to 4,000 loaves of bread a day. Now there's four full-time workers here, but every day we'll have about 20 people who will come and stand at these machines and slice and package the bread. Those are all volunteers. We know right now the congregations in the valley who have been invited to have volunteers come all the rest of this year, and we're starting the assignments for 2009. So that this bakery knows that on December the 10th, such and such a congregation will send 15 people here to help slice the bread. If we were to go about 10 miles south of here, you'd come to a pasta plant where we make lasagna and macaroni and noodles and spaghetti. If you went east of here about 3 miles, you'd come to a soap plant where we produce about 8 or 9 different kinds of soap products that we didn't go over and look at in the storehouse. If you went north of here about 20 miles, there's another big white grain elevator. That's where we make our wheat and white flour, a wonderful pancake mix, rolled oats, granola, and package a few other products as well. If you went to Houston, Texas, we'd find a peanut farm and a peanut butter manufacturing plant where we make our own peanut butter. So it's part of a larger system, and all of those operations utilize volunteers just as the concept with the bakery.
And these are all non-for-profit productions?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. All designed to bring product into our system that can be made available to a bishop who's trying to help someone in need. Giving them every opportunity that we can for them to succeed. And the welfare program, that's the primary goal of that, is to help people be self-reliant. And also, one of our goals in this system as well is to encourage service. We've found that's why it's so volunteer-oriented. We've found that if we can get people to serve one another, something happens to their own heart.
Yes, that's been proven by a lot of sociological and psychological research as well. Did Joseph Smith have something to say about this kind of commitment? I know you've quoted the scriptures a lot, but what about Joseph Smith?
He did have a great deal to do, and encouraged the concept of fasting and making a contribution, even in a period where the saints had very, very little to offer. We were challenged to reach out beyond just ourselves, but to reach out to the whole world, anxious to bless the whole human race.
And did this all grow out of the original history of the Mormons in this valley? I mean, did all of this organization begin in those early years?
There's always been a requirement, if you will, of our church leaders to be concerned about the needs of their congregations and to reach out to help them both spiritually and temporally. So, yes, that has occurred from the beginning of the church. It was during that Great Depression period when we found we had to do something more and kind of then sped up, if you will, the organization of a formal system to make it happen.
So the formal system really began on the back of the Depression of the 1930s.
Yes. All right, our next stop is across the street into that cannery. But we have a little a golf cart right here that we'd like to invite you to get on.
Back out in the winter snow.
I'm in Salt Lake City, and you're with Rachel Kahn on The Spirit of Things. I'm finding out that the Mormon take on welfare is not about getting the dole. Well, we're on our way indoors to the canneries. Elder Jim Goodrich is my guide and the manager of Welfare Square in Salt Lake City, Utah.
This is one of about 110 canneries that the church operates. So we do spaghetti sauce, salsa, I have several different kinds of jam and jelly, and a applesauce that's really quite good.
I think that's what's going on the Beltway now. It's either the apple or the pear.
It's applesauce, yes. As you look at this, that commitment to service is ingrained. You don't see a full-time employee out there right now.
No, I guess they're all women here. Are they the ones who have more time to volunteer?
They're usually the ones that are home during the day and have that opportunity, but they're often you'll see a mixture. I think you'll probably see a few men along the way.
Rachel, I've spent many hours at a local cannery near my home doing things such as sorting turkey meat for canning, cutting and peeling pears and apples and peaches, and doing any number of things that are required given the season that those things become available.
When did you do that? When you were a bishop or before then?
Oh, no, it's something I've done off and on for many years. And when the opportunity comes again, I'll do it again.
And frankly, we find it rather enjoyable to go and participate in a canning session. It's an opportunity to mingle with others and to be a part of something that you feel good about. We just stop right here.
Thank
This is an example of what we call a dry pack or home storage center. We're operating about 100 of these. It's a place where members of the church can come and package food that they can buy and send home. I didn't explain that on the other end down there. This is the only time in our system where the product we produce is for sale. If you come into the canneries and assist in helping produce the product, then at the end of that, you're eligible to purchase some of the product. That's the only way you can get it, is you have to come in and work for it.
And most of the people here are fellas, actually, aren't they?
Maybe the women and men had an agreement today. I don't know that there would be any correlation. Male or female, you see both on a regular basis. But here's the concept behind this home storage. We've been invited by our church leaders to have at least a 3-month supply of food in our homes of things that we would normally eat. We also store a little drinking water, that we have some financial reserve available that we could use immediately if necessary. In Katrina, we found that within just an hour or two after the floods, all the banks were closed and the ATM machines were empty, and everybody was on the street, the wealthy, maybe being less capable than the homeless folks to care for themselves. And then as we get this accomplished, then to add to that a variety of foods that would store for a long time that you can just put away and know that you've got a safety valve there to feed your family if there was a serious emergency. Food packaged the way we package it here will last 30 or more years.
Elder Goodrich, I've read that Mormons are anticipating the return of Christ and that this kind of storage is really meant for that time.
It's not necessarily meant for the future. It's meant to be available at any time when there's a need. If I were to lose my job or lose my health, but certainly we do believe in a second coming of the Savior, and that during that time up to His coming, that there may be some very difficult trials that we will face, economic and natural disasters, etc., that may come. And
the tribulations.
So we want to be prepared.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's really a philosophy of preparedness.
It's probably served a lot of people well at the present time when the banks have foreclosed on their mortgages and so forth.
That's true. In fact, the majority of people on their home storage find that it's used for everyday kinds of challenges that arise.
Back into the golf cart.
Rachel, I think it's fair to say that there's also preparedness for need, but also preparedness for opportunity to give. We wouldn't want to be the only ones in our neighborhood who were eating in a time of drought. We'd want to be able to share. And I think that's another part of the universal motivation behind this system.
That was Mike Judson, the public relations officer of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and with him, Elder Jim Goodrich. You can hear more of that interview by going to our website at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. Australians were among the early members of the Mormon Church, and a boat left Sydney in 1853 with 30 on board. In fact, the earliest organ built for the Mormon Tabernacle, the home of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, was made by an Australian.
The early Mormons had a love of culture and a love of music. And so a man came from Australia and brought an organ that he had made, and his name was Ridges. And so Brigham Young saw his work and said, "Do you think you could do something for the tabernacle?" Now, this guy didn't make a real spectacular organ. They traveled back east, looked at a music hall in Boston, and they wanted a lot of money for the organ pipes. And he said, "I can do this myself." So he went to work, and this is some of his work. So they're not round pipes. They're actually square boxes. And they're assembled as a box would be, with square sides. They brought up wonderful lumber from southern Utah that had a certain kind of wood quality for tone. And they put stops in certain places in them and to give the tone they would provide. But it was done with pioneer tools.
And with a guy named Joseph Ridges, Joseph H. Ridges, organ builder. And did he stay around?
Yes, that name Ridges is still in the church today. I know a few Ridges. And was it coincidence, or does the Lord put people where you need them? Sometimes I think people have been key in history, and they just have the right talent, the ability to expand. And this is the work he would do.
You can see how it compares to today's organ in the Mormon Tabernacle by going to our website at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings, where you'll find a photo gallery of images from Salt Lake City. Australians are mad about genealogy, and they share that with the Mormons, but their reasons are different. Most people who research their ancestors end up using the Mormons' unparalleled genealogy records. Daniel Schlieder works in the Family History Library in Salt Lake City.
Well, an awful lot of people are very interested as to why we do genealogy, why we have such an interest in it. And it's mainly because members of the LDS Church have a very strong belief and feeling for the unity of families. And it's part of our religion is that families should be sealed together and made an eternal family. And for that reason, Mormons feel like they have a religious obligation to seek after and learn about their ancestors. The purpose of this library is to acquire the kind of records that will help people do genealogy, to preserve and protect them, and to provide access to those materials. Now, we don't collect original materials, but rather we preserve them on either microfilm or now many of our projects are digital. This provides access to those records throughout the world so that people have access to that information. Our collection gathers historical records of all sorts, particularly those that have specifically vital records, birth, marriage, and death records, the kind of stuff that will help link families together so you can find out who is parent to whom. We gather records from all countries, every place that we can, all ethnic groups, and all social classes, so it's for everybody. We feel that genealogy is important, and because we collect this material for the Mormons, for their religious purposes, we also make it available to everybody. Now, people also ask where the money comes from to finance this incredible library. And basically, the Genealogical Society is incorporated as a nonprofit educational institution, was founded by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and it is funded by the LDS Church, which is headquartered here in Salt Lake. Originally, we just started collecting books and stuff. But in 1938, the technology developed that we could start microfilming original records. And we started that in New England, and we were beginning to start some microfilming of vital records and such in Europe, but then the war came. And so that was halted until after the war. And right after the war, a lot of records which had been misplaced and displaced during the war ended up in Berlin. And so a man named Mr. Lang Heinrich started arranging to get that material microfilmed. He's terrified these records were all going to be burned or shipped off to Russia and lost, so he was very concerned about that. And in the years after that, in the late 40s and early 50s, we started microfilming in Scandinavia, Germany, and other places. And we've now, of course, the library has over 2.5 million rolls of microfilm. And we also have 350,000 digital folders. One folder would be all the records of a particular parish. We've been gathering those records digitally since 2001. We have approximately 200 camera operators who are capturing records digitally and on microfilm in over 45 countries. And now 75% of our acquisitions are done digitally. We also have a program of oral genealogies. Some cultures do not have a strong record-keeping tradition, but they do have a strong tradition of memorizing and learning their ancestry. We have done projects in the Pacific Islands, from East Asia, Taiwan, from Southeast Asia, Indonesia, and Malaysia, and also now we're working on oral genealogical projects in Africa, the Gambia and Ghana and Nigeria. Now, the original microfilms and the original digital images on CDs and DVDs are stored out at the Ground and Mountain Vault Record Vault, set about 15 miles south of us. It's in a canyon up there. We have six vaults that are bored into the mountain. That's where we house the master copies of our collection. It's very carefully humidity controlled and temperature controlled, so it's an ideal situation for preserving and protecting those original records. And that's where we also make duplicate copies so that they can be distributed to various family history centers and to the library here in Salt Lake. Most of our collection is pre-1930. Right of privacy concepts prevent us from having recent records. Generally speaking, we microfilm in local repositories all over the world. We've microfilmed. And these are then cataloged according to where they were filmed, what they pertain to, and the institution that created them. As far as gifts, because our collection is so much used, many, many people do their genealogy, and then they want to share that, and so they will then present to the library a copy of their finished work. So we have a wonderful collection of books, and increasingly that is being presented also digitally so we can make it available to other people. Now, you can use the collection of our library here at Salt Lake City at the Family History Library. We have over 4,500 family history centers all over the world in 116 countries. Also, several major libraries have access to our collection. And we have a website, which is www.familysearch.org. And that has our catalog, shows exactly what we have in our collection. And some of our materials are actually now available as digital images online. In 1999, we started converting our whole catalog over to a digital format, and we created the FamilySearch.org website, which currently gets over 14 million hits a day. That's a very popular website. This building was opened in 1985, and we have some 1,900 patrons visit this library daily on an average. Now, the dead of winter, we don't get as many, but in the summer, we get a lot more, so that's an average. Here's an example of some of the material that we have from Australia. This is an 1891 census from Sydney, and we've microfilmed that, and that's available on microfilm here. Here's another example of a newspaper record from Trinidad and Tobago, a marriage index, which has been published, and we have that here. And people, like I say, people can, some of 4,500 different family history centers, people can go out and use our collection. Or if they can't actually get the roll of film, they can order that film and have it sent to the Family History Center there, and they can use that. And the fee for that is just basically the postage costs. So that's basically what we have here. That kind of gives you an overview, but then I'd like to show you more of the collection and show you some of the different floors that we have.
How do you actually go about acquiring this material? Do you write to the governments of countries and request access to their birth and death records? How do you do it?
We have a team of negotiators stationed all over the world. We have an Asian group. We have several European groups. We have Latin American groups, Pacific Island groups. And their job as negotiators is to try to arrange for us to microfilm the records. We also have a unit called the Collection Management Unit. Their job is to identify what records exist in each country, which would be the best to get, so we can help set up our priorities, which records would be most important to acquire. And since we have limited resources, we have to be careful that we don't get more than we can afford to acquire. Previous to this job, I worked in the European Collection Management Department, and we were able to determine what records were best from each of the European countries. And then, of course, we have to prioritize the countries, because our main priority is to acquire the records that are of use to members of the LDS Church. That's what this collection was created for. But we also want to create a good balance of records and to get the records that are going to be used the most. So from Poland, example, is not as high a priority as Germany, because a lot more Mormons have ancestry from Germany. Nevertheless, we have a very good collection from Poland, partly driven by the fact that some Mormons do have Polish ancestry, and also the fact that those records are perhaps in a little more danger of being lost, and so we have taken the opportunity to acquire them. In some cases, we provide the equipment for the microfilming. In some cases, they do.
Have you ever encountered countries that are quite touchy about that? I mean, is it a difficult thing to negotiate? Have you come up against brick walls?
We've had very good success in most of Europe, but, for example, in Romania, we've never microfilmed. We have some Romanian records that we filmed in other countries, but thus far, we've not microfilmed in Romania. From the Czech Republic, for years, we wanted to microfilm those records and always were basically told that they weren't accessible. And just 2 years ago, we were able to successfully negotiate for digital projects with several of the individual archives. In fact, you'll be able to see those online shortly. I'll show those to you. But we are having a lot of success now in the Czech Republic, microfilming. And actually, it's a digital project, not microfilming, but we're having access to those materials, which is making a lot of people very happy who have Czech ancestry.
Like me.
Like you.
We're in the Mormon Family History Library in Salt Lake City, Utah, and there's a link to FamilySearch.org on our website at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. I'm Rachel Kahn.
This descendancy chart starts with a very obscure family, Robert White and Bridget Alger, who lived in the 1500s in Britain, in Essex. The remarkable thing, though, is that among their many, many, many thousands of descendants, we have traced these prominent people. For example, there's Lucille Ball, who is a descendant of that family through the Loomises and then Prestons and finally up into the Ball family. Philo Farnsworth, the inventor of the television. President Gordon B. Hinckley, the recent president of our church. Joseph Smith. Donnie Osmond. Steve Young, the football player. Emily Dickinson is also descended from them, as well as members of the Continental Congress, signers of the Declaration of Independence, like William Williams, Shirley Temple, Wilbur and Orville Wright, and Ulysses S. Grant. It's interesting that all of these people trace their ancestry back to this obscure couple.
Astonishing. That's certainly 6 degrees of separation,
isn't
I think.
Well, some of these are very distant relationships, yeah. This is just some of the highlights of prominent people, but they must have millions of descendants in the world today. We really are all one enormous family, and I think that's kind of important to realize how closely we're all related to each other.
So given that there are prominent Mormons, in fact, Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon Church, what would the interest be then in these ancestors? Is it the case that Mormons would want to seal them? Or
we would want these. Because these are eternal families, we want those families to have the opportunity to be eternal, and that requires ordinances that we want to prepare to do for them. And so we have a desire to seal these families together for eternity, and that's our goal, is to do that. Individual members of the church are doing the same. They're trying to trace their own ancestry, figure out who they are, and then seal themselves back as one eternal family unit. The fact that these sealing ordinances are done has no meaning unless that individual, who we believe lives on in the spirit world, we believe that that person still has the decision and choice to make as to whether they accept that or not. So the fact that Lucille Ball has various ancestors, I don't know if anybody's done ordinances for them because I don't think she was a Mormon, but when sealings are done, the individuals for whom that ordinance was done still has the opportunity to decide whether they accept it or not.
So no one's up there sealed unwillingly?
No one is sealed unwillingly, no. And, you know, I've met some people that didn't particularly like their wives, so some of them probably have chosen not to be sealed. I shouldn't be surprised at all.
Daniel Schleter. Among the resources of the Family History Library is a British Jewish database called Legacy, developed by Todd, who works in the library.
This is Todd Miller.
Hello. Sorry to be behind a microphone.
It's okay. It's fine. Yeah, on this program, this is Legacy. This is the program that puts three generations out here together. So here's husband and wife, all their kids, and if we knew the parents, they'd be up here. So it's kind of nice, easy to see the whole family all at once. My own Jewish family is from Poland. My ancestor, who came to the States, came here in 1850. I have no English Jewish ancestors. However, in his journals, which I have, he was in England for about 3 or 4 months. And in there he mentions attending the Great Synagogue and so forth, and he mentions the names of those people who helped him. So I started researching them because I wanted to know more about my great-grandfather. So I started researching them, and it's just being on the British floor of this building, having the access, it just kind of blossomed from there. So.
And are you a member of the LDS Church?
I am. I am. My great-grandfather converted from the Jewish faith to the Mormon faith. And so that's where this has come from, is trying to learn more about him, finding the people that he talked about who influenced his life, And it's just grown into a collection that's now 33,000 names or so. And it's available. It's, you know, it's available to the world free of charge.
It's online.
It's online. It's on familysearch.org. And you can just click on it and download it or view it on, as a PAF file. So whatever genealogical program you use at your home, you can download it for free.
And so is your intention to seal your family ancestors?
This here has nothing to do with it. I will, my own family, you know, I will, but none of these in here have anything to do with it. This is just to find out more about my Jewish ancestor and the people who influenced him.
Well, good luck. It looks like you're a long way towards doing that.
Well, thank you. I hope so. I hope it helps people find their families.
A lot of the Jewish people in Australia would probably have British ancestors, mm-hmm. and so this could be a very valuable database for them to use.
Yeah, they certainly do. In fact, a very large portion of Australian Jews derive from England.
We do have some Australians in here, quite a few. And here's a Hart family that ends up in Australia. So they're being added too. There's some excellent sources coming online all the time for Australian records.
Some people have protested against the sealing of their ancestors in a Mormon ordinance, including Jews who've discovered that victims of the Holocaust have been thus claimed by the church. I asked Daniel Schlieder about it.
There have been a few situations where, especially several years ago, where a few people actually inappropriately baptized lists of names, and that was inappropriate. And those names were all removed. And any time one is found at this point, if someone finds a name that has been inappropriately submitted, that name is removed because it is inappropriate. On the other hand, an LDS person who has Jewish ancestry, of course, they should be able to do their genealogy. Now, they may have a cousin who's not a Mormon, and they might be upset, but it's a matter of religious freedom. If that person wants to fulfill his religious obligation to do his ancestors, the fact that he has a distant cousin that's upset about it is unfortunate, but it's a matter of freedom of religion, and that's something we enjoy in this country, is people have the right to worship according to their own dictates of their own conscience. This concept of doing these things for our ancestors is a part of our religion. It's something it's a religious obligation, and so they do it. And I've been so pleased when I've been able to help Mormons with Jewish ancestry. But also, I've helped so many Jewish people with Jewish ancestry, obviously. And some of them have said, how can I get these names into your IGI? I said, well, that would require Mormon ordinances. I don't care.
What's IGI again?
The IGI is an International Genealogical Index. It's an index of names that have been processed. Now, increasingly, it's an index of names that have been processed from various sources. So some of the names in the IGI have not had LDS ordinances done for them. They're just have been submitted. And the reality is, if you don't believe in this faith, what difference does it make? And on the other hand, if you do, then you're doing a mitzvah. I mean, it's a mitzvah to do something good for these ancestors.
Is that a Mormon mitzvah?
It's a Mormon mitzvah.
This is the first time.
Right.
Thank you for that.
You're sure welcome.
Well, that was a surprise, but no more so than discovering that a special treat in Salt Lake City is deep-fried kosher pickle. Wonders will never cease. We heard from Daniel Schlieder. This year, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir's Sunday broadcast, Music and the Spoken Word, celebrates its 80th birthday. The program was recorded in Salt Lake City. Photos and extra interviews are on the web, plus a link to familysearch.org. Just go to abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. And when you're there, you can read a transcript later in the week and download the audio. Sound production today was by Russell Stapleton. Later in the year, we'll return to the Mormons to delve into their dramatic history. I'm Rachel Kahn. Join me again next week when I report from Queensland on the new religion of interfaith on the Spirit of Things.
On the book show on Radio National, procrastination, writer's block, self-doubt. These are the enemies of many writers, even highly experienced writers with gongs to their names. Helen Garner says she still feels awful before she starts writing because of uncertainty about what she's doing. She contemplates the role of play quite literally in the sandbox and other techniques to deal with it. That's on the book show. Download or stream the program from the Radio National website.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.